Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. This week marks the 50th anniversaries of Medicare and Medicaid. 46 million older adults and 9 million people with disabilities depend on Medicare for basic health care and economic security. Medicaid covers 70 million children, pregnant women, low-income adults, and people with disabilities. At a time when an overwhelming percentage of the population supports expanding Medicare, how are the media reporting on this program, and why isn't Medicaid getting more attention in the media? Today we're joined by Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer for The Second Opinion, CJR's healthcare desk. Trudy was recently on Your Call talking about her Harper's cover story, Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Great to have you back. We're also joined by Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, an editorial independent news organization at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Hi, Mary Agnes. Welcome back to the show. And we're also talking today about Turkey, which is back in the headlines. The Turkish government has agreed to join the International Coalition Against ISIS. So far, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have joined in or supported U.S. airstrikes in Syria against ISIS. But the Turkish government seems to be more interested in attacking the Kurdish positions of the Kurdistan Workers' Party in northern Iraq than it is going after ISIS positions. Turkey has NATO's second largest army behind the United States. Joining us to talk about coverage is Roy Gutman, an Istanbul-based correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, where he covers Turkey and the Middle East. Hi, Roy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Nice to be there.
It's nice to have you. So as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Trudy, why don't we start with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
The piece I want to mention, I think, was published a little bit more than a week ago, and it has to do with the food inspection system in the United States. And the reporter is Helena Botmiller-Evich from Politico. And I recently did a CJR piece about her and her great reporting showing that the great food inspection bill that had been passed by Congress in 2010 has not been funded, and it doesn't seem to be any prospects for funding it. So we have a lot of food that's going uninspected in this country, and it's really rather frightening.
And I've read a lot about uninspected chicken and shrimp, for example. What did she focus on?
Well, she focused on the products that have had serious recalls recently that have resulted in deaths. One big recall happened last summer, or this year, I guess, on a creamery in the Midwest had contaminated food and lost their entire inventory. But in what I looked at in terms of the piece that I wrote praising her work was the recalls that have been announced voluntarily by companies recalling products. And you're right that there are a lot of recalls involving chicken products, millions of tons of chicken products, chicken nuggets, chicken pockets, and so forth have been recalled.
I just read recently that a million chickens are killed in this country every hour, which is just, you can't even wrap your head around that. Why is this department so underfunded, Trudy?
Well, FDA is underfunded. I want to be clear that USDA does other kinds of inspections, but chicken products often come under the purview of FDA. And what happens is that they just have not appropriated the funds to make this law work. It was a decent law that was passed 5 years ago, and it was passed with the support of the food industry. But as Helena pointed out in her story, the symbolism of the law may be what they were looking for rather than the substance of the law and tough regulation that would really clamp down on some of the food contamination that's plaguing our food supply right now.
All right. So kudos to Helena
Bott Miller Evick.
Thank you. Bott Miller Evick at Politico for writing about food inspections. And that is Trudy Lieberman, who also wrote about Helena's piece in an opinion called Food Safety Law, Good for Consumers If It Were Funded. Trudy is a longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. And what about you, Mary Agnes? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw a really interesting piece from Noam Levy at the LA Times, looking at these parallels between looking back to the creation of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965 and the Affordable Care Act, which we know has been through a lot of political wrangling and legal challenges, and sort of casting these parallels about how both Medicare and Medicaid at the time, you know, a lot of attacks against creation of the laws, a lot of concern about would you have enough doctors, would you have enough nursing homes, and so on. And he kind of took you through how Republicans and Democrats worked together to reshape those laws, with the sort of thinking that now that the Affordable Care Act has survived, you know, several appeal votes on Capitol Hill, it's survived several Supreme Court challenges, that perhaps as it continues, that it might be shaped. There may be some kind of bipartisan movement to shape the law over time, because it looks like it's here to stay. I just thought he did a great job with that.
All right. And so thank you for that. We covered Medicare earlier this week. And then, like I said, we had Trudy on talking about her cover piece, Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. And Mary Agnes Carey is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. That's an editorially independent news organization of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And what about you, Roy? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, the story that impressed me the most, I was traveling, so I didn't read. I wasn't up to all my usual reading. What appeared in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm trying to find the names of the authors. It was just about a week ago, and the journal sent its reporters into Kurdistan. You know, the northern, Kurdistan regional government, which is North Iraq, and spent time with one or more of the volunteers in the group that's an offshoot of the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers Party, which is a banned terrorist group, in one of their offshoots, and stayed with her for days, obviously, and got a real feel for who these people are, what their goals are, how they operate, and so on. I thought it was a great enterprise piece, because we write about various Kurdish groups all the time, and especially the fighting groups, but we don't really know that much about who the people are and what motivates them. So I thought the journal did a really fine job, and I'll come up with the name a little bit later on in the program.
And so what did you learn from this piece? Who are these people?
Well, there's a lot of young Kurds who either volunteer because sometimes they have fights with their families, or in some cases they're drafted by the PKK or one of its offshoots. But in this case, I think the young woman was a volunteer, and they believe in the in Islam or the the major religions. They have a kind of a syncretistic view of different religions come together. They have a political ideology that is sort of neo-Marxist. They want a kind of a socialist state. They talk about a state without a hierarchy of leadership. Things that sound very utopian, hard to believe, but they believe them. And that alone helps one understand why this group is so elusive and out of the mainstream in terms of contemporary politics. But part of its power is, I think, in having a unique mixture of philosophy that borrows from here and there, and that is very different from the Arab states or from Turkey.
And Roy, I think I found the piece. Did she talk to a number of young women?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There, I think three authors, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and so it's called A Personal War: America's Marxist Allies Against ISIS by Matt Bradley and Joe Parkinson.
Yes, that was the one. I thought it was really a great read. Quite frankly, I wish they had stayed longer with the subjects and really spent time with them as they go off to the front, as they fight, as they do other things, because there's been very, very little shown about them in the mainstream media for years. And the media that's favorable to them gives a very one-sided view, and we really need independent reporters to go in there and come up with I hope, an unbiased perspective.
And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. That is Roy Gutman. He's an Istanbul-based correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, where he covers Turkey and the Middle East. So let's talk about what's happening there, Roy. Turkey is back in the headlines after the government agreed to join the international coalition, which includes Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, led by the United States. So these countries have either joined in or are supporting U.S. airstrikes in Syria against ISIS. Can you talk about how the United States was able to pressure Turkey to publicly support its policy in Syria?
You know, there's a general view out there that Turkey has been unsupportive of the assault on the Islamic State, that it has even been sympathetic with them, that it has facilitated their movement in and out of via Turkey into Syria and into Iraq. And I have to say that I hear these charges all the time, but I have not been able to demonstrate on the whole, except for the movement of people, that the Turks have been anything but on the side of the international coalition in opposing the Islamic State. But the Turks have had a real problem with American policy, which is that they don't think it's serious. They don't think that bombing a force that has a political base is going to change them, or that's going to really remove them from the scene. And in fact, that bombing from 30,000 feet in general is not the way to solve a problem on the ground. I have a helicopter going overhead here. And so they've been very reluctant to open up their bases to an American plan that they think is really geared to appeasing American public opinion, but not changing the situation on the ground. Now, their assessment of the situation on the ground is that the Islamic State insurgents did not just come out of nowhere. They were, in the case of Iraq, we know it was political neglect of the Sunni. It was discrimination against them by the Maliki government that sort of created the ground for the Islamic State to take root. In Syria, it's quite a different story. The Assad regime, according to the Turkish perspective, by all sorts of actions, some of them going back 10 years, some of them more recent, has consistently acted in ways that have benefited the Islamic State and almost encouraged it to take root. And so the Turks have had a position for at least 3 years now that the essence of the problem of instability in Syria is the Syrian government. You have to somehow remove it or replace it. And the Obama administration has been completely unwilling. They've been unwilling even to set up a safe zone for refugees and for internally displaced people. And, you know, half the population of Syria are either refugees or internally displaced. It's stunning.
Roy, did we lose you?
No problem. Oh,
okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you're still there. Go ahead.
And I think what happened was that suddenly they came under attack a couple of weeks ago with an incident, and it's not the first time where the Islamic State operatives came into Turkey and blew people up. In this case, they blew up a group of people who were sympathizing with the Kurds of Kobani who wanted to go there to work. 20 or 30, at least 30 people were killed. And I think that for the Turks, that was the trigger that they had to actually take an active role with all of their misgivings about American policy, that it was time for them to act. But of course, incredible coincidence, Kurds from the PKK also started attacking in a major way even before that. So this is why we have the Turks fighting on two fronts. I don't think that this was planned.
And Roy, you report that Turkey insists the goal of all of this is to overthrow Syrian President Bashar Assad, but the U.S. says the only target should be the Islamic State. So where do you see this going?
I see it going into terrible confusion, and I don't see it leading to a stable and satisfying result. I think that the U.S. has got to come up with a policy that actually works for its regional allies, as well as for itself. And I think the Obama administration has been very reluctant, and this is probably primarily during the negotiations with Iran for the nuclear deal. They didn't want to upset Iran, whose primary ally is Syria, and who's actually keeping Bashar Assad in power. And they didn't want to rile the Iranians. Now, that agreement's been reached, but I don't think American policy has changed. And they have to. And listen, Syria is the toughest problem on earth in many ways. It's not just because Assad is staying and because he's got a lot of support from the Iranians and the Russians, but it's that all sorts of forces have now taken the field and dominated. And in fact, you know, the Americans said they were going to train rebel forces who would be under American command and control and be fight the Islamic State. They sent in 54 just about 2 weeks ago, and they're now under siege from one of the jihadi groups, from the Jabhat al-Nusra. I mean, it is a mess. It is a colossal mess.
Well, we're going to have to do a show about this. Mary Agnes and Trudy, before we let Roy go, I know you don't cover this at all, but do you have any questions about him, or does anything strike you about the media coverage that this is getting?
Well, are we getting enough media coverage of what's really happening there?
Right.
Right, exactly. And I think the way he's explaining it and breaking it down is incredibly helpful, because I think a lot of Americans look at the situation and don't know who the groups are and don't know what it's about and can be somewhat dismissive. But I love this very conversational way that he has, you know, that you have to explain what's going on there.
And Roy, what are you working on right now?
I was just in Iran for a week, looking at the whole issue of the regional disputes that Iran has with nearly every Arab country and with Turkey, Israel, you name it, and whether after the possibility that either Iranian policy will change or that somehow we're going to find a way to resolve these disputes. Because, you know, if you have four wars going on in one region and with no sign of abating, you could have a bigger war yet, you know, a regional war, which would be a disaster. So that was the question I was asking there. But if I can just throw in one idea,
sure.
Just to the discussion of the, you know, the point that was just made about how we need more coverage. I think the number one story that's not covered enough certainly in the Syria war, is the human story. We need to know about what's happening to real people and why. Why are they fleeing their homes? Who are they? What kind of people are they? I mean, my impression of the Syrian people is I think that they're real people, and they're really interesting people, and they've got a culture and a history. And I think that they've been sort of let down by the international community because nobody cares about them. Mm. Everybody's talking about war or talking about, you know, the PKK or ISIS,
right.
But they're not talking about real people.
No, that is so often the case, and I'm going to add that to our story list because I think that's such a good. We need to really focus on that. So thank you for that. And Roy, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, anytime.
Roy Gutman is an Istanbul-based correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He covers Turkey and the Middle East, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And now we are going to talk about coverage of the 50th anniversaries of Medicare and Medicaid with Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy was recently on Your Call talking about her Harper's cover story, Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. It's an editorially independent news organization of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And both of you have been covering Medicare and Medicaid extensively. Medicare especially has gotten a lot of coverage in the news because of the 50th anniversary. We'll talk later about why Medicaid doesn't get as much attention. But Trudy, what really stands out for you about how the legacy of these programs have been reported?
Well, I'm going to take a step back, further back than this week, because there has been some coverage this week noting the fact that Medicare has been around for 50 years. And that is cause for celebration, clearly. And it's very nice that we're having these happy birthday stories. But there are significant issues dealing with the Medicare program that have not been addressed by the media for a very long time now. And I've been noticing this because this is an issue that I've covered for many, many, many years, and I know the program fairly well, and have been observing the coverage of Medicare. And for some reason, the
press just kind of likes to walk away from it. And I've written many columns for CJR about it, urging coverage. And in fact, we have a huge archive of my posts. And there's certainly a ton of good stuff on Kaiser Family Foundation website as well. And a lot of Mary Agnes's reporting fits into all this. But aside from that, there has really not been a lot of day-to-day coverage of some of these very important issues dealing with Medicare. And the main one that I have been watching now for 20 years is this sort of move to privatizing Medicare. And the genesis for this really goes back to the 1990s, and I won't go into all of the political details, but there has been a move afoot to try to make Medicare into something other than a social insurance program, which it is. And I think that's very fundamental. And the problem is that reporters and the general public and even people who are on Medicare do not really understand what it is. And if you ask any person on the street or in a Walmart here in Pennsylvania, where I am today, if they really understand Medicare, they say, oh, no, but they have AARP. And they really couldn't live without it. That's the typical answer that you get. The elderly population knows they have insurance. They know they have some kind of supplemental coverage, maybe a Medicare Advantage plan, although they don't know that necessarily by the name. But they know they need it. But they don't know the ins and outs of the program, and I would guess that most people on it over these 50 years have not known the ins and outs of the program. And that has been very difficult and has worked into this movement by certain people and certain people of certain political persuasions to try to privatize the system and turn it into something that looks more like the Affordable Care Act, which is really a private insurance scheme, getting more private insurance into the hands of people. And so we have a whole long history of this movement toward privatization in very tiny little incremental steps. And indeed, in 2003, that really opened the floodgates really for the Medicare Advantage plans, which are Medicare benefits provided by the private insurance industry, that we really have seen a big movement toward this. But I think most people don't know that that's happened. Hmm. And my guess is that we are going to see a continued movement toward this. Certainly, we're going to hear a lot of talk about it in the election, and right, depending on who is elected, we're going to hear a lot more about it.
And Medicare covers 46 million older adults. 9 million people with disabilities depend on Medicare. And Mary Agnes, for a recent piece you wrote, you point out that 10,000 people a day are becoming eligible for Medicare as baby boomers age. You also report that many Republicans have backed a premium support model, in quotes, where the government would give beneficiaries a set amount of money to purchase coverage from a number of competing plans as a way to limit Medicare spending. Is that a nice way of saying privatize Medicare, these premium support models?
Well, here's the thing. I think, and Trudy's kind of hit it on the head, you have to look at how many people are in. She's talking about Medicare Advantage, right? You have nearly a third of Medicare beneficiaries that are in that program. Many people are finishing their work lives. They're used to private insurance. They're looking at Medicare Advantage, and enrollment is ticking up, right? And I know we're not talking about Medicaid right now, but there's an extraordinary number of people. I think it's more than half of people on Medicaid are in managed care, right?
And Mary Agnes, I'm so sorry to cut you off. I just wasn't even looking at the clock. We've got to take a quick break. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation, the phone number, toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather drop us a line, you can send your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 today, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Then at noon, it's the Tavis Smiley Show. Following that at 1, Latino USA. Here on Local Public Radio, KALW, a listener-supported community broadcast service.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with David Cohen and Kristen Connan about their new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. Since 1993, 8 abortion providers have been murdered. Several others have been assaulted by anti-abortion violence. So what will it take to stop this violence? We will also get an update on the Planned Parenthood attack videos. And then on Tuesday, we'll speak with Christina Rizga about her new book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and the Teachers Who Made It Triumph. That's on Tuesday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak about coverage of the week's news. We are talking about coverage of the 50th anniversaries of Medicare and Medicaid with Trudy Lieberman, longtime contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. It's an independent news organization at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What strikes you about coverage of these programs? As Trudy said, not just this week, but they are often in the news, especially Medicare. And in the lead-up to the presidential election, we will be hearing more about these programs and effort to privatize Medicare. And sorry I had to cut you off there, Mary Agnes, but we were talking about the recent piece that you have, and you report that Republicans are backing a premium support model where the government would give beneficiaries a set amount of money to purchase coverage from a number of competing plans.
Right. My point is that this is going to be an ongoing political debate, right? Trudy talked about it. We're probably going to hear about it in the Republican presidential debate next week. I think the role for the press, the way I see my role in this, is to look at this and explain to people what it really means. How much money are you talking about that would be given to a beneficiary? What are the competing plans that are there? Is Medicare, traditional Medicare, which covers two-thirds of the people on Medicare right now, is it put on the same playing field as Medicare Advantage, right? How are the options set up? What do they have to cover? What standards are the plans held to? What does it work? How does it work? What does it mean for the beneficiary? There's tons of confusion. Trudy hit the nail right on the head about Medicare. People don't understand how the program works. USA Today had a fantastic story today explaining this, how people do not understand Medicare. When I do radio or television shows, I will constantly get questions about what is Part A, which is the hospital coverage in the traditional program. Some people don't even know if they're on traditional Medicare or Medicare Advantage. So where a lot of the stories, and I understand them, the political stories mention these things in a sentence, right? But what we like to do at Kaiser Health News is unpack and simplify these things and take the reader through what it might mean to them. And that is where I really think the press corps can just play a phenomenal role for the public.
Why do you think that that angle doesn't get enough coverage?
Because it's hard to do. Hello?
Trudy, you want to jump in?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's very hard to do because the reporters themselves do not understand Medicare. And they call up and they don't understand Part A or Part B or Part D either. And sometimes I think there's not really much of an excuse for not knowing it because there really is a lot of information that sort of explains all the nuts and bolts about this stuff. But for some reason, they shy away from it. And I had one Boston reporter tell me a couple of years ago that whenever she's handed a Medicare story, her knees start shaking and she starts quaking. She doesn't want to cover it. And I think that that's the reaction of many other people. But I do want to make one point that Mary Agnes made about the premium support and what's likely to happen here. It's really a fundamental change in the way Medicare works in that a great chunk of the cost of care will be shifted from the Medicare program itself to the beneficiary. And it will come in the form of high deductible plans, perhaps $6,000 was talked about in one proposal a couple of years ago, maybe more, maybe less. It will take the form of no more first dollar coverage on a Medicare supplement policy, but the Congress has already begun to change that. In 2020, there will be no more coverage of the Part B deductible. And so I think that that shift that we have seen institutionalized with the Affordable Care Act could very likely continue with Medicare. And I don't think that people understand that fundamental
possible shift.
And also, what about the people who are relying on Medicare? 46 million older adults, 9 million people with disabilities. And I find that when the media talk about Social Security, for example, cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, the people are often missing from these stories. And again, in your piece, Mary Agnes, you write that most Medicare beneficiaries don't have a lot of money. They spend a large chunk of their finances on health care. And you write that in 2013, half of all people on Medicare had incomes below $23,500 per person, and premiums for Medicare and supplemental insurance accounted for 42% of average total out-of-pocket spending among beneficiaries. I mean, this is something that's also really greatly missing from the coverage. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's, you know, that the a lot of times these very important issues are sort of treated at a 50,000-foot level. And like Trudy's talking about, I've had the same conversations with reporters. They sort of don't want to get into the details. They don't want to mess with it. They don't want to put it in their stories. But I think that this is the type of thing where editors need to be more aware of it. Reporters need to be more aware of it. And they just need to be maybe spend a little more time at senior centers, talk with people. I mean, that income number, that $23,500, that is eye-popping.
Yeah.
I mean, the average person at retirement has like $62,000, maybe $70,000 in their 401k. That's barely enough for a year in a nursing home. Heaven forbid they have to go there. So I think it's just sort of, you know, with this 10,000 baby boomers going into Medicare every single day, it's like a wake-up call to the press corps, to editors, to the public. I mean, as we know, newsrooms have been cut to shreds all over the country. You've got reporters covering health care and education, and they might be doing fire and cops in one newsroom. And, I mean, one thing about our model here at Kaiser Health News is that reporters and editors can use, they could take the story that I wrote that you're talking about, they could use those facts in their story, and all they have to do is give us credit. And part of the reason we're here is we're a national nonprofit healthcare news service to try to promote coverage of these stories and get the facts out there to people. So, you know, I think it's just one of those things as reporters see more of that in their community, reporters and editors, they're just going to have to focus a lot more on the details versus the, you know, the high-level debate on this stuff.
Right. And the horse race has begun with the presidential campaign, and so we're getting all of these quotes from all of these presidential candidates, especially the Republicans running. Jeb Bush was slammed last week for saying he wanted to, quote, phase out Medicare. But Trudy, how do you see this? I mean, this number is pretty staggering. So if there's 46 million older adults relying on Medicare, half of them, again, had incomes below $23,500 per person. Why aren't we hearing more about that?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, the Medicare Rights Center in New York has made that number available a lot, and they certainly do use it. I don't think it finds its way into stories, but I can tell you from my own reporting down in the trenches, which I try to do quite often, people are struggling. People at all income levels are struggling, but the elderly are struggling too. And I think it's sort of a myth that's been perpetuated in the last 20 years that the greedy geezer is out there trying to consume more of the national income, and that we have to cut Medicare, we have to cut Social Security, we have to cut the COLA on Social Security. And the reality is that there are millions of people who are not doing very well. And I think that that has not been addressed. I think we have to look again, and this is taking a big picture look, that Social Security and Medicare, when they were enacted, have done tremendous things to improve the lot of people over 65. There is no question about that. But what's happened, because the price level has risen and healthcare costs continue to go up, that these populations have really struggled a lot, and they're struggling more. And a few years ago, I was at a senior center, actually, talking about the lack of food, actually, that many of these people face. And I said rather naively to somebody there, well, of course they have Part D now, which is the drug benefit, so why are they spending so much on their pharmaceuticals? And I realized that that was a really stupid question right when I asked it. She said, you don't understand. She said,
they are paying so much more for rent right now. They are paying all these deductibles for their health care, and they're paying it for their medications as well, even with Part D, and they're paying higher electric bills. She says they just can't afford it. So, of course, in this context, food was dropping down to the bottom of the list of what they were spending their money on. So I think in any debate that we have going forward with Medicare right now, that we have to look at who those individuals really are. And they're not the fat cats sitting on the east side of Manhattan particularly. They are people in California and San Mateo County and wherever who are really, really struggling. And I would hope that the press doesn't lose that perspective, because it's so necessary to tell the story in any movement that is going to shift even more of the cost burden to the beneficiary is really going to be hurting them. I mean, they're paying high levels now, and you're going to hear a lot of people talk about, well, they're already paying X number of dollars for premiums and deductibles and so forth. And if you just go into these private arrangements, they might be able to pay less. Well, maybe so, maybe not. But if you give them a policy with a $6,000 or $7,000 deductible, people who are on Medigap policies now for their supplemental coverage, who are not necessarily paying those higher costs right now, that cost will be shifted to them, and what are they going to do? And I think that's the question that both Mary Agnes and I are urging the media and others to start asking.
Trudy Lieberman is a longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, an editorially independent news organization at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Today we are talking about media coverage of the 50th anniversaries of Medicare and Medicaid. In a few minutes, we'll talk about why Medicaid doesn't get more attention. But what are your thoughts on these programs and the coverage that you've been hearing and reading about over the past week and maybe even the past year? How do you think the media reports on these? We're talking about the fact that a lot of people don't even know how these programs run, even people who use them, and then the realities facing the people who are on Medicare and Medicaid. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Mary Agnes, what are your thoughts about all of the attention that Medicare receives when it comes to funding? So I was just Googling Medicare and fund. Franchise Herald, Social Security, and Medicare are running out of funds. Cycle Intelligence, as Medicare turns 50, does it still make financial sense? There's so many articles about how Medicare is running out of money. What are your thoughts on how that's being reported?
Well, here's the deal, okay? The Medicare trustees, this is a group of experts that sit down and look at the Medicare program, okay? Now, they say in 2030, it will start to run out of money, right? It starts to not be able to pay 100% of all the costs of the program. And so when they make that kind of, you know, they make that pronouncement, that is a call to the public and to lawmakers and federal regulators that, you know, the amount of money coming in must match the amount of coming out. So I think the ability of not being able to pay 100% of the bill, but it's something like 86% or something, that to me is not running out of money is like, oh, my wallet, I got nothing, okay? They still have money there paying. It's not enough. It is a call to action for sure. But it is not the desperation of running out of money. I think that's one of the talking points. You hear that a lot. I'm based in Washington, and you hear that a lot on Capitol Hill. Medicare is running out of money. No, it's not. It's not running out of money. It's going to have a shortfall in 2030, which is, you know, not that far away unless they make changes, in part because of this demographic shift. But it's, again, you know, it's and maybe I'm just in the middle of rhetoric central here, you know, and you can get spun a million different ways. But that's, again, where you have to say when you're the reporter, you really need to sit down. If someone references the trustees report, go look at the trustees report, right? Mm-hmm. Look at it and see for yourself what they're talking about, and just don't take what somebody tells you what they're talking about.
Philip Mueller, a healthcare reporter for the NewsHour, wrote, "The Medicare Trust Fund, which everyone thinks is very important but really isn't that important, is projected to cease being able to pay out all of its benefit obligations by the year 2030. This is the same year as was projected in last year's report. The reason the Medicare Trust Fund is not that important is that it covers only hospital expenses incurred under Part A of Medicare." Trudy, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, I think we have to understand
understand a little bit about how Medicare is financed. Part A, which is the hospital benefits, is financed by the payroll tax. And that has always been the case since the inception of Medicare. And there have been dire predictions about the Part A trust fund running out of money ever since I've been covering this. And a lot of people believe that at some point, because Medicare really has never gotten a total grip on the high cost of care, there have been many attempts, and we don't have time in this program to go through all of them, to try to curb those costs. But for a lot of reasons, and a lot of it has to do with the providers pushing back against Medicare's attempts to rein in prices, a lot of people believe that the hospital trust fund may need an increase in payroll taxes down the road. And of course, we have been in an anti-tax mode in this country for at least a couple of decades now, if not more, and nobody wants to talk about that. The other parts of Medicare, Part B, let's talk about the medical part of that, is financed by premiums paid by beneficiaries, as well as general tax revenue. Again, somebody has to pay that. Are they going to increase premiums more? That's clearly an option. And then, of course, Part D is the drug benefit, and that is also privatized a bit and financed in a different way. But I think the two that we have to concentrate on are the hospital trust fund and how Part B is financed. And there are a lot of powerful people in this country who don't really want to pay any additional taxes. And so one of the solutions, you either do your best to try to control the cost of care, which Medicare, to its credit, has tried, and they are continuing to try and have all sorts of experiments going on to see whether they will bear fruit. And the other part is to shove those costs to somebody. So do you do it through the taxpayer? Do you do it through the payroll tax and employers pay more? Do you do it through another additional privatization and make people pay larger cost sharing, very similar to what people have with the policies under the Affordable Care Act? And I think those are the questions that need to be addressed in any kind of press coverage and any kind of public discussion about what we want this program to do. And I think those issues have not been made explicit to the public.
We have an email from Martha in Oakland who says, I am now on Medicare. I went with a Medicare HMO because it was the cheapest thing out there with the most coverage. The AARP plans are at least $50 a month plus $104 coming out of Social Security for Medicare. She says, I paid Medicare and Social Security taxes my entire working life. I don't see it as an entitlement but a right. What should I be on the lookout for right now and in the next few years? What would you say, Mary Agnes?
Couple of things. Number one, I would say make sure when the open enrollment period comes around in mid-November that make sure, Martha, you've got the best deal for you. Are there other plans? Are there other choices that might work better, that are more affordable? And are there, depending on her income, are there any programs through Medicare that help low-income folks pay those premiums and cost sharing? That's one thing. The second is watch the politics. We're coming into a presidential election cycle. We've been talking a lot here about how Republicans favor limiting the federal contribution to Medicare beneficiaries, what that might mean, what's happening. That's sort of one. She's got to keep one ear on that as well so she can help shape the debate. But that's how I would guide her.
And what would you add, Trudy?
I think those are good suggestions that Mary Agnes made. Depending on her income, she should look at the programs that are available for people on Medicare who have low incomes because they are underused. And I also find that that's often sort of tragic because they have some help available for people, but people don't know about them. And if she's in California, she should certainly talk to the California HICAP program, Health Insurance Counseling Program in California. It's an excellent resource, and the counselors out there are generally terrific and can guide her to her options. And I would second what Mary Agnes said, that certainly shopping around at open enrollment time is important. And I know it's tough. I know it's daunting, and I know there's not a lot of clarity in some of the information that's provided. And I would certainly urge her to go to her local HICAP office and ask for some personalized help.
And Brenda from San Francisco couldn't stay on the line, but she wanted to point out that signing up for Medicare and Social Security is time sensitive. And if you miss the window, you will be hit with charges. So thank you for that comment, Brenda. And I also wanted to talk about Medicaid. Dr. Alice Chen, a doctor in the Bay Area, recently had a perspective on KQED. And she said something really interesting about Medicaid. She said Medicaid, known as Medi-Cal here in California, is a health insurance program for poor people jointly funded by federal and state governments. So it looks different in every state. It took 17 years after its inception before the last state threw in the towel and decided to participate. She says despite the fact that Medicaid now insures 1 in 5 Americans, nearly 1 in 3 in California, public support is far from universal. Obamacare allowed states to dramatically expand Medicaid, but refusing to expand has become a political litmus test on the right. Why the difference, she says? Well, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Google Medicare patients, and you'll get a predominance of smiling elderly white people. Google Medicaid patients, and you primarily pull up images of kids and people of color. We thought that was really interesting, Trudy. What are your thoughts on that?
Medicaid has really been a stepchild, I think, of the health journalism beat for a very long time. And I think largely because it involves people who are very poor. And we in the media don't really like to talk a lot about poor people. And editors kind of avoid those kind of stories, at least they used to. I mean, we do see every now and then some story popping up that talks about that. But a lot of people also on Medicaid are not people of color. There are, in many states, more white people on Medicaid programs than people of color. Medicaid is a very good program. The benefits have always been quite good and quite generous. That said, the states have had a lot of trouble funding this program. The Medicaid budgets in the states have increased and crowding out spending for other things like roads and schools and so forth. And a lot of the governors have been unhappy with that kind of thing going on. And the issue, again, here is the underlying cost of care. And so what happened in the Medicaid expansion, a lot of people have speculated on whether the 20-odd states that have yet to expand have not done so because of the racial issues and so forth. But I think there's more to it than that. And I looked at this extensively in Tennessee recently. And the main reason for not expanding in that particular state was that the Republicans are waiting for a new administration to come in where they can block grant the program. And that means, generally, when you block grant a program, money coming from the federal government is reduced because generally it's not an entitlement sort of program where there are appropriations and it just goes, but that there are chances now to kind of rein in the cost of the program through this block grant. And actually, the federal share will decrease if that does happen in many states. And I think that that's the underlying political thing that's going on here, and that will hurt a lot of people. And we at CJR have been trying to write about Medicaid a lot over the last couple of years and urging reporters all over the country. And I see a lot of good reporting being done on Medi-Cal in California, by the way. But in other states, it really hasn't taken off. And I guess the reason is that there's this idea that it deals with poor people, and readers and listeners don't want to hear any more about poor people.
Even though there are so many of them in this country, again, Medicaid covers 70 million children, pregnant women, low-income adults, and people with disabilities. Mary Agnes, what's your read on Medicaid and why it's not getting as much attention?
Again, if you're going to report on this, look at the program, right? This is sort of the code. It's, you know, for poor people. Here's some of the facts about Medicaid that I think aren't often reported. It covers two-thirds of people in nursing homes. Okay, long-term care is not Medicare. That's Medicaid. A third of all children, Medicaid covers a third of all kids, nearly half of all births, and a lot of these people are working. They're the working poor. They might be the people that you deal with every day in the service industry. They're out there working. Maybe their employer doesn't offer coverage. Maybe they can't afford the employer's coverage. They go to the Medicaid program. I mean, there's sort of the image that you cast, you know, the pictorial image, and then there's what it really is, especially the nursing home angle. Almost everybody knows someone in a nursing home, and very few people have the money to finance it out of their pocket. right? So you have to go, you can't transfer assets and play games and this kind of thing with the Medicaid program. There are rules against that. But most beds in a nursing home, two-thirds, are covered by Medicaid. And that, those are the kind of facts when a reporter understands that sort of thing and realizes the nuance and the depth to the program, you can write a whole lot of stories that are very different than the kind of run-of-the-mill stuff that causes this, you know, societal divide, if you will, between the two programs that may exist for many people right now.
And Mary Agnes, we've got about a minute left. What are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm trying to continue to watch development of the ACA on the regulatory side, the Affordable Care Act on the regulatory side, and also on Capitol Hill, and basically, you know, gearing up for the 2016 election and all the health issues that will be in play, including the health law.
And Trudy, what are you working on?
About the same thing Mary Agnes is working on. I think there are no end of stories for both of us and many other reporters to write about the continuing unfolding of the Affordable Care Act. Every day there seems to be something new to write. But I also think Medicare and Medicaid are really important issues, and I know we'll be writing a lot more about these issues as time goes on. And as I say, there's resources on our website, cjr.org, and on the website of Kaiser Family Foundation that reporters and the public can go to for background as the political debate gets going.
Well, thank you, both of you, for covering this issue like you do and also giving so many of the 125 million people who rely on Medicare and Medicaid a voice. Trudy Lieberman is a longtime contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. It's an independent news organization of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What is life like for abortion providers? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with David Cohen and Kristen Conan about their new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. Since 1993, 8 abortion providers have been murdered. Several others have been assaulted by anti-abortion violence. What will it take to stop the violence against clinics and their employees? We'll also get an update on the Planned Parenthood attack videos. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Join us this Saturday on Folk Music and Beyond for a program of new and recent releases. We'll hear the latest by the Vishten Trio from Canada, the Alan Kelly Gang from Ireland, and from here in the Bay Area, the contra dance band Stringfire. Also, new American roots recordings by Rhiannon Giddens, the Decemberists, the Punch Brothers, and the Weepies, and from England, singer-songwriters Olivia Cheney and Richard Thompson. That's new and recent recordings on Folk Music and Beyond this Saturday, starting at 3, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Anu Anand, live from New Delhi. How fair is the law in India?
We're talking about the dignity of the dead. We're talking about the criminal justice system. We are not talking about a P.D. James novel.
7 years after an Indian teenage girl and her family's manservant were found murdered at home, a new book on the case raises serious questions about justice in India. Is it blind or blind to evidence? Does India's noisy and vibrant media help or hurt? Syed Ali writes on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay, law in India, what law? And Amir says there is a different law according to your religion. We'll hear from the family at the heart of the case, the journalists who pieced the story together, and from other Indians. What does this tragedy tell us about the world's biggest democracy?